Drag queens all around the world love using French words and names as part of their act. But what about drag queens in France? Surprisingly, many of them use American-sounding names and English expressions from their favorite TV show, RuPaul's Drag Race.
Today, Parisian drag queen Sasha Kills joins us to talk about the drag scene en France. As a painter of the canvas and the body, Sasha Kills blurs the lines not just between genders, but also between beauty and horror.
Listen as we have a tete-a-tete with Sasha Kills about how American drag is en vogue in Europe.
Plus, Salvador Dali and Marcel Duchamp as the original artsy French drag queens.
What is the proper spelling of the word chanté?
And life after Violet Tchotchke got kicked out of a sex club in Paris.
I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun.
Feast of Fun is made possible because of fabulous people just like you. Thank you. Unlock a delicious world of podcasting magic and listen to thousands of amazing shows at feastoffun.com/plus.
Hello.
Bonjour, Sasha Kills.
Bonsoir.
Comment ça va, ma petite?
Ça va très bien, et vous?
Oh, très bien, baby.
Très bien. We're very happy to talk to you today. And from your, you're at your place in Paris.
Yes. Yes, I'm at my place right now.
So you're a drag queen living and working in Paris. Let me ask you, other than getting thrown out of a sex club and posting it on Instagram, what's the drag scene like in Paris? You know what I'm referring to, right?
Yes. I mean, it's very good as long as you're not Violet Tchotchke. Then people love you when they know who you are.
Yeah. Is that typical for the Paris drag scene to just get like thrown out of places?
No. Did you follow this whole thing? Did you see the end of this situation?
Well, what's the end? What is le fin?
So for people who are not familiar, Violet Tchotchke, who was the season 7 winner?
Sure.
Of RuPaul's Drag Race. She found herself in a very popular nightclub in France.
Sex club.
Mm-hmm. But it's also a gay bar, like, you know, heterosexual, cisgendered people hang out in the top, and then there's sex in other rooms and basements in other areas, right?
Yeah, but I mean, on the top floor, there's still like a lot of gay porn. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's still very sexualized anywhere you go. But yeah, you're right. It's still in the underground that things are happening.
And she got thrown out, but then and she made a big stink on Instagram. But then the bar said, you know, she was taking photos in places she shouldn't have been taking photos. And that's not why we're there. And that's why we threw her out. And that they were considering taking legal action against her. And then her response is like, listen, everybody, just forget about it. I'm over it.
Yeah, because I think it was on both sides there were problems. But mm-hmm. It's true that she filmed downstairs, which is strictly forbidden. And she tried to say that it was because she was presenting feminine and another guy was also presenting too feminine. And it was, but it's really not true, actually. Mm. It's kind of weird situation, but it created a good conversation between drag queens and masculinity in Paris. So I guess it's good.
Well, you know, as Americans, when we think about masculine men, we don't necessarily, the first men that come to our mind, we don't think of French men as necessarily very masculine.
Oh, wow. Okay.
am I not correct?
I don't know. It depends on what you mean by masculine, I guess, but...
Well, for Americans, it's hard to tell. Like when you see a European, you're like, is this person European or are they gay?
I know, and some of us are gay and European. Can you imagine? That's a lot.
That's called intersectionality.
Yeah.
And so how did it resolve? I guess the club take action. What was the name of the club?
Le Dépôt.
Le Dépôt, yeah. Mm-hmm. Le Dépôt.
Which would translate in English, like, I guess it would be like the garbage disposal.
I thought it was like Home Depot, like, you know, where you get your hardware.
Like very dirty and, you know, like it means something like where you throw your trash.
Oh, okay. Because there was also like wasn't there some toilet night or something they had there, I think, too, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
But it translates to garbage can, basically, or dumpster.
Yeah, like a kind of a dumpster, but it's a play on word. It's kind of And yes, it was like this party called La Toilette, the toilet. Mm-hmm. And it's a fashion week type of party. So people that who don't go to the depot normally, they go there. That's why, I guess, why Violet wanted to go there, because it's this one time where it's not as sexual as other nights, I guess.
Mm. So how does this conversation in Parisian LGBT nightlife gone after this incident? Because it certainly, you know, a lot of people were talking about how we need to create a welcoming atmosphere, that sort of a desire for only masculinity is problematic. I mean, where are we right now with all this?
I think it's still very complicated here because, for example, as you've seen with this problem, a lot of people didn't even know who Violet Shashki is here. And I think most gay people don't really know personally a drag queen, because there's not that many of us here. So they're not used to like people playing with gender. So masculinity is still a very strong issue here. It's kind of, it's hard to explain, because I sometimes just feel Paris is like an older version of New York, like New York like 15 years ago when it comes to relationships between people and gay. It's not as diverse as you would think. Even if I know, like as Mark was saying, sometimes you have this image of like European being very liberal, being very gay. It's not how I feel it. No, it's more a man has to be a man and a woman has to be a woman, and the gray area is not very encouraged, I would say.
Mm. And so, like, what's the drag scene like then there? So, like, do you go out to a bar and do you lip sync to songs?
It depends, because here in Paris you have a lot of little spaces for drag shows, but they're more for impersonations. So it's like a cabaret in a way, mm-hmm. meaning that you have a cast that is fixed, and it's more like you're playing celebrities. Like French celebrities or singers, and it's not really creating your own persona. It's a very English and American thing.
Now, are they lip syncing to songs, or are they actually singing themselves?
Both, but here in France, people still prefer to have people sing live, because for some people, it just shows that you have like a real talent in a way.
Sure.
And so people tend to prefer that, but I think it's really changing now because of RuPaul Drag Race and like having performers from other parts of Europe or elsewhere coming. It's changing really fast.
Well, because, you know, it used to be back in the day, the most part of drag, and I think probably when like Fausta was coming up of age, a lot of it was, you know, celebrity impersonation. So it would be people doing Liza Minnelli, Judy Garland, you know, Carol Channing, all these people, like they were trying to emulate that kind of thing.
Well, certainly, you know, in the late 80s, the first time I ever saw a drag queen was somebody who was trying to do Diana Ross. Mm. And a lot of drag queens, you know, before those John Waters films with Divine, most people's concept of drag queens was pageant girls. And verisimilitude is a word that gets thrown up a lot of times. This passing, trying to look like a woman, as opposed to creating this otherworldly, beautiful creature of your own imagination. And for you, you know, Sasha, I'm looking at your Instagram, and I'm very inspired by the fact that no matter where you would be in the world, you would be considered an avant-garde drag queen. There's a lot of Asian, there's a lot of horror, there's a lot of futurism in your drag sensibility, and certainly, like, I love your call-outs to sort of Pan's Labyrinth and sort of Chinese opera all rolled into one grotesque, beautiful being.
Oh, thank you so much. All the references you just said are, like, they're masterpieces to me. So, yeah, I'm inspired by so many things. I'm first a visual artist, so I didn't start with drag. It just happened as an accident, and it's just because I wanted to start doing things other than just drawings and etchings. I wanted to perform and create something. For me, it's really a creation, you know?
Well, so your body and your makeup is an extension of your canvas as an artist.
Yes, and it's in a way, it's sometimes more gratifying because you have an instant reaction with the audience, and you can try things very, like, whereas when I'm working on an exhibition, it takes months and months. Here, I can change it up pretty quick.
Does it make it more personal when somebody doesn't like your work because it's on your body as opposed to hanging up on a wall?
I think the difference would be that in a way when I perform, I would get paid. It's not like when you're doing an exhibition or in the artwork is selling or not. And people, when they approach you after your performance, I never had really somebody giving me like a bad feedback straight to my face. Plus, here again, to come back to the difference between Europe and the US when it comes to drag, people here are not that educated when it comes to drag. So you don't have like the Drag Race fans like in the US being like, what you did is so 2002 ago. Or, you know, there's not like the drag critics yet. But they're coming, I guess.
Well, it feels to me that one unintentional and very negative impact of television on Americans is that it makes us think really poorly about art and culture in a way that doesn't foster creativity and build community. It makes me realize that a lot of people find themselves experts or think of themselves as experts on drag because they watch a lot of television.
Yeah.
And I had this problem as a drag queen and as a visual artist when I was going to graduate school at the School of Art Institute here in Chicago. And I had a teacher tell me something that was really profound and wise. She said, when someone looks at experimental art, like a painting, they're not having any kind of, they're looking at it from a very humble perspective because they're not watching it on television. But because your work deals with so much popular culture and people are very familiar with popular culture, they find themselves to be an expert and tend to be much harsher on you than they would on someone like a cubist, for example. And so in a lot of ways, for us being sort of gender nonconformists, for being people who merge pop and experimental art and marry these worlds together, we sort of bestow upon ourselves the hardest path to take because not only are we dealing with the bigotry of the whole world, we're also placing ourselves in a situation where the audiences that watch our work are coming from a place of ignorance and fancy themselves experts.
But isn't that exciting, though? I mean, I wouldn't have it any other way. It's so exciting to have, I don't know, to have this shock value when you're bringing something that people are not really used to see. And sometimes I like, even if people don't really like the performance right away, I think when you just have people reacting, just having an emotion about what you do, whether it's good or bad, at least they're feeling something. Because as you were saying with television and all of that, we have so much access to all of it, but you're not really having an emotional reaction to anything anymore, I feel.
Are you saying that we're too complacent? We're too apathetic?
I'm just saying that I think what I'm doing with my drag, for example, there are things that I'm very inspired by other performers, by shock queens, by John Waters movies, but a lot of things that are from the past, but people just don't know. And for example, just me doing like a very violent performance with fake blood, sometimes it's the first time that people see that, which would be surprising right now in 2018. You would think that people would be used or over this, but no, because we see everything on television or in books, but seeing it live, it's really rare here.
It's a different matter.
Well, that's why I find like a television show like Dragula, you know, it's in its infancy. And sort of the Dragula right now in its first two seasons is very much going to grow into something huge, but also it represents so much more potential than I feel that RuPaul's Drag Race isn't, because it's making us uncomfortable. It's getting us out of our comfort zone, and you know it focuses on individuals that if they could cure their homosexuality, if they could cure their weirdo-ness, their otherness, they wouldn't. There's a lot of people who, and this is the dark side of drag, that for a lot of people it's like, Some people say, I wish I was a beautiful woman. If I was a beautiful woman, all my problems would be resolved. And then there's other drag queens who say, I don't want to be a beautiful woman. I want to be this manifestation of myself. And if you love it or hate it, it doesn't matter to me because I'm an artist and I need to speak my truth. And that independence and that kind of authenticity to me is much more radical. And in some ways, Dragula, I predict in 10 years from now will be much more relevant of a television show than RuPaul's Drag Race.
You think so?
Yeah. I'm saying right now.
I love Dragula so much.
I think Dragula has more potential to change the world than RuPaul's Drag Race does. It's a show that has problems in terms of like narrative and, you know, storytelling and documentary filmmaking. But its heart is in such a good place, like your work, that it is where I sense a lot of audiences are very excited about. And in a lot of ways, you know, like I'm watching All Stars. I'm not excited about the drag itself, the artistry. I'm excited about the people, the interpersonal conflicts,
like the storytelling.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a storytelling show. It's not about art.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not thinking about how the queens look as much as how the queens insult each other, the alliances they're making.
If they're putting paper on a wall.
Exactly. like, no one's talking about, you know, Trixie Mattel's music, and it's really a beautiful, she's a beautiful musician, and the fact that the show hasn't really brought up her music at
it
all.
It might come soon, you
but,
know.
But at this point, we're almost halfway done.
I'm anticipating a redemption arc.
And maybe we'll see that, but
she did showcase, like, music abilities, though, in the Thailand show.
For a brief moment, we saw her playing a musical instrument, and that was over. And the fact, you know, musicians are always with their guitars playing when they're off time. We never see that her in the workroom pulls out a guitar and starts playing it. And that, to me, is a missed opportunity to show art. And so a show like Dragula, I think, is actually going to be... explores that, the life of an artist, the struggles of an artist.
And what did you think of the season 2 compared to season 1 of Dragula? I'm curious to know what you think.
I fell in love with Disasterina. I thought she was... she was... and it made me also realize what excites me is drag queens like you that are visual artists who marry the art gallery and the gender nonconformity into a performative way.
When I was watching it, like Disasterina, I felt like you have a lot, because I know a little bit of your profile, of course, like I've been listening to your podcast for a while now, and I felt like you have a lot of things in common with Disasterina in your way of thinking, and I felt like you had something in common, and me too in a way, but she wasn't, I don't think it was the best stating for her to win anyway, but
it doesn't matter who wins in these shows.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter who wins. It matters how they get to tell their story. And I felt like someone like Disasterina, she disappeared. You know, besides the Boulay brothers are so much fun to watch in doing anything. And to me, it's really fun to see them just torture these drag queens.
We try and torture as best as we can on Clicking with Drag
Queens.
We're
very kind. You know, but we also have a mischievous.
We make them chop onions.
We make them chop onions. Yeah. We give them a knife and they're terrified. But we're sort of like intellectually scaring them, and they're like physically scaring them to some degree, you know, like pulling out a paintball gun and knives and tattoos and, you know, putting their feet in cold water to, you know, I was talking about this with Vivacious. She says it is one of the cruelest shows on television.
It is. But also it like, I think they're one of the biggest drag stars from this TV show, because I'm really obsessed with Van Der Von Odd, like the first winner.
Yeah.
Because she's doing a lot of things. I was in LA for 2 months this summer, and I saw her perform a lot. And she does these things with technology and visuals at the same time. It's very inspiring. And when it comes to look, the last season, even though she did not that great at the end, I felt like Abora as like one of the craziest drag look I've ever seen.
Well, the thing that excites me about Abhorra's look is that she really, I'm not sure if she's conscious about this, but I think
sure
about
either.
Like those old Betty Boop cartoons that were sort of psychedelic and monstrous and I mean, terrifying. I can't even sit and look at them because I'm going to get nightmares. Old Betty Boop cartoons freak me the fuck
out. Disasterine is the one with the beak, right?
The beak.
Okay.
And she looks like a monstrous Mickey Mouse, yeah, you know? And
some crazy chicken.
Yeah. And she just is something, you know, and to me, like, I look at your visual work correct me if I'm mispronouncing your name, Marc Saussier.
Yes. Good. Well, you speak Spanish, so
oh, yeah.
I guess, yeah, so I guess you're the one who can pronounce my name.
Well, and I love how your work is tied to this French legacy of Marcel Duchamp and Salvador Dali, and just this fascination with the disfiguring and the slicing and the distortion of the human body. Can you talk a little bit about your visual work?
I mean, I worked on a lot of different projects, but yes, as always, as you said, I think here in Paris and in France in general, we have a very heavy influence of classic drawings, of figure drawings, of the proportions of the body. But also, I think if we would compare to a city in the U.S., Paris is really close to, like, big cities on the East Coast, of course. So mm-hmm. we like the dark things. We're not afraid of, showing uncomfortable things. And it's, I think my work is, it's hard for me to speak about it because I feel like they are different projects, but it's still, it's like a lot of mix between human, animals, mm-hmm. that merge, that create hybrids of other things. That's why also it translates in my drag, because sometimes I have big discussion with other drag queens because they're like, you're not a drag queen because you're not always appearing feminine. And I'm like, but I'm transforming into something else that should be what drag is, transforming into something that you create. And I think it's the same thing with the visual art.
Well, certainly there's a lot of inspiration of those Salvador Dali paintings. I believe The Temptation of St. Anthony is the right title of it?
Oh, yes.
With the elephants and the giraffes, with giraffes' feet, you know, and just this kind of the way you're marrying, the heads of hammerhead sharks with a human body and slicing it up like a, almost like a serial killer, you know?
Sexy Sharknado.
Yeah, there's definitely like a transgender aesthetic into your artwork. I don't know if you yourself identify as such, but I'm curious to see like how your personal feelings about your body relate to your own art.
So when like it's going to get a little bit personal, but first, yeah, I was born here in Paris, but I was actually adopted. Mm-hmm. But I was born here in Paris, and so I sent you some of my pictures, but I'm presenting, I would say, as like a mix. I mean, I'm light skinned but light brown skinned, so I'm mm-hmm. not looking like a typical French guy if that exists anymore. But I was raised in a very white Catholic family, so my parents, they're blonde, they're very European, you know, very like strict education. And from a very young age, I learned, like maybe when I was four, like a child went to me and was like, you're not looking like your parents. They're not your parents, you know? And I think that the moment I learned that what I'm projecting to the world and what I'm inside are two different things. Because inside, I'm typically like a French white guy because I've been raised in this family, in this culture, that's all I have. But when you don't know me, I'm presenting as something else. And it could have been something that made me really sad or that created trouble, but I made it like a strength. Mm. And so to answer to your question about like the transsexual thing, I'm not really feeling this way, but I feel that what I am inside is much more than what I'm presenting on the outside. It's not about male or female, it's something more.
Is that part of the reason why you feel like you do drag? Is because you are something on the inside and then there is something yes. else on the outside?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. But it's also something that I've accepted that it's changing. It's not, for example, I do a lot of clown drag. I do a lot of things that are disturbing, but it's not necessarily because I see myself as this thing. It's just that I feel it's ever changing, and you have so much aspects of yourself that you can present to the world. And that's what drag is to me, is that you choose like an aspect of your personality and you exaggerate it to the max.
I think, you know, certainly like that's something a lot of people can relate to, especially people who come from multiple heritages. You know, the idea, you know, I grew up with the idea that you don't look like a Puerto Rican person. And I got that in Puerto Rico. I look too American, and in the United States, I'm too, you know, everybody always looks at me like I am an imposter wherever I go.
Sometimes I wonder if this is my husband. I'm like, is this my husband?
And even then I ask myself, and this is a, I think this is a reality, not just for people of mixed heritages. But this is also a reality as LGBT people that we face, that we're not real men or real women or real Americans or French, you know, we're not real citizens of our communities because of the fact that we don't fit those definitions that people have placed upon us. And so that's part of our attraction to costume and artistry, is because it's a way for us to put into outside of our minds this experience that we have such a hard time putting into words.
But I think also like the difference would be that when I was adopted, it was back in the 80s, and in France there was the law that you could actually like let your child at the hospital, but you don't give any information about yourself. So I really have actually no clue of what my ethnicity is. What I would have to do is actually go to either England or the US and do like the test, the DNA test, to know exactly what percentage I have.
You can't do the DNA test in France?
No, it's forbidden.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's forbidden.
It's illegal to do a DNA test in France.
They don't want people's biometrics?
Yeah, and I kind of understand why too. Because, for example, when I was living in the U.S., because as you, Foster, I was studying at SIAC for a while in Chicago. And I was always shocked when I was applying for internship or anything, and they're like, you have to put like what your ethnicity is, you know, and it's not compulsory, of course, but you feel that's something that doesn't exist here in France, like this thing where you have to tell people what your ethnicity is. I think that's something that's different.
So Rachel Dolezal could qualify for an African-American grant. That's what you're saying. She lived in France.
I'm saying that she would never, during a job interview, have to answer this question, like on paper or anything. Which anyway, I know it's very hypocritical, because anyway, people still see, and like with a name, or they can. That's also the difference, because my name is very French. So when people meet me, they're like, "Oh, you're different."
I don't know. I'm looking at photos of you in on Facebook out of drag, and you strike me very Parisian.
Oh, because I'm very Parisian, but I'm not white.
Well, yeah, but I don't think of all French people as being white. Just I don't think of all Puerto Ricans being brown skin, or all Americans being, you know, one color or another.
I agree, but that's different from, that's not, I wish everybody would think like you, because here, I've been living here my whole life, and when I go out or anything, people still talk to me first in English or in Spanish, and not in French, because even though we are mixed here, it's not as much as in the U.S., for example, where it's like a big melting pot.
Sure.
If you had a striped shirt and a little scarf around your neck and a beret, and you were just like selling baguettes, you would fit right in.
You have to dress the part.
That's all you need. You know?
That's what I should do.
Why not? I mean, drag allows you, you know, I just tell people, it's like, listen, we come in all shapes, colors, and flavors, honey.
Well, you know, Paris is a very international city, too, but, I mean, the French do have a lot of problems with race relations and bigotry.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we do. And it's showing even in, like, well, you know, like, I feel, again, anywhere you go, the gay community is, like, an exaggerated version of the problems that you have in all society. Mm-hmm. So, but it's more like free to say, no, I don't like that. No, you appear more this time.
I think Zach Stafford came on and he kind of explained it to us why it sometimes seems as though gay people are more racist than straight people is because the gay community is very much smaller. And so we often have to encounter people in our own community from different races. And so sometimes those tensions can have more of a spotlight.
It's easier for us to be racist when you have somebody to be racist to.
Yeah, exactly.
If all the people surrounding you are the same ethnicity, visually look like you the same way, you're not going to be able to do something about it that hurts another person.
Well, you hurt
the ones you love, the closest to you.
But I agree with you, Fausto, that even though French people, they don't necessarily look all alike, you can really spot somebody from France anywhere. There's like something, even when I was living in the US, I could see somebody who's French or European from very far away. I mean, it's something...
They're probably skinny, right?
Yeah.
they're white. They have a long nose. And their clothes are probably fit well. They're not sloppy dressed, right?
Yes, that's right.
They look like they're either going to hop on a yacht somewhere.
So Gerard Depardieu, get the hell out of here. I'm curious to understand, like, you know, certainly the fact that RuPaul's Drag Race isn't this juggernaut in other countries as it is here, but it certainly has had an impact on drag queens. Has there been pressure for drag queens in Paris to tip each other, to lip sync more, to sort of fit those conventions that the TV show brings up?
Yeah, I feel like there's been a renaissance of drag here like these past 2 years, and it's starting to be shown even more. I feel like the younger generation, like the gay guys between like 16 and 22, they all know about RuPaul's Drag Race, and a lot of people now start performing because of RuPaul's Drag Race. So it's kind of weird to see you go into a French gay nightclub or bar, and all the drag queens have like English names and performing only like English music, like top 40 American things. And or even worse, they do like exactly the same numbers as the RuPaul girls, but not as good, of course, because you don't have the same budget or like somebody filming you.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting because, you know, a lot of the drag queens have French here in America, have French names because they sound, you know, more fancy. Sophisticated and fancy, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, like, why aren't you calling yourself, like, Sasha Mortz, or
Lemaitre,
or how do you say death?
Assassin.
Well, I have a reason why I have actually, like, an English name. I got my start in the U.S. When I was living in L.A. after Chicago, and I studied at Mickey's, and I had to find a name real quick before performing. And I just took like the first name of like this hero of Pokemon, because here in France it's not Ash, it's Sasha.
Ah, yes. He's the hero from Pokemon.
Yeah, I think in the US the name is Ash.
Mm-hmm. That sounds right.
Yes, and I liked it because it was something that could be like both male and female. And I like that. And Kills, because there was like this singer that now has no career because she just lost her mind, which is perfect for me. Natalia Kills, because she had a great aesthetic, and I had just like to find a name in 5 minutes, and I was like, okay, I like it, let's take it.
Well, what do you call a drag queen in French?
Now because of the RuPaul Drag Race, people are starting to say drag queen, but before it was like in Spanish, transformista, transformiste.
Transformiste. Yes. Which in English means to transform yourself.
Well, do you call gay men, do you call them queens, ren? Like, do you say ren?
No.
You don't say
They're not like, ren, no.
La reine, no?
No.
Because I was talking to my German friend, Eric, and he's German, and so I call him Königin, which is, you know, queen in Germany. He's like, we don't say that.
No, like, we don't care. Should I do it like in a French bitchy accent when I say that? We don't say that.
Yes, exactly.
We don't say that.
Do guys turn to you and say, yes, queen, yes? Do they do that?
It would be funny if they would be like, we, queen, we. But it's like, yes, queen, yeah. Like a sheep, you know? You're like vomiting blood on the stage and you're like this little guy in front like, yes, queen, yes.
In Spanish, we have a word for that is anglicismo, which is a words in English that are not translated because of the appeal of using them in the native English tongue. What word? How do you describe that in French?
It's actually the same name, but without the A, like transform it. So it's anglicisme.
Okay, yeah. So it's the same idea. Mm-hmm. I basically am French, you guys.
Yes, you are. I mean,
one of my favorite word anglicisms is that in French they say the look for like le if you look. Have a certain look.
Yes,
you know.
For which, what?
For le look, right?
No, we say it, but maybe we could say style.
Yeah.
Ton style, ton look.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it works.
Yeah,
but I get really mad when I'm in the US and you really feel like they're putting like French name everywhere, but it's not the right use of it. So they would say, "Let's go to le plage," and it's la plage. You know, like there's like the feminine and the masculine name. It's really different.
Well, we do that all the time in Mexico and in Puerto Rico. Gays love to say the la instead of el, like the female pronoun. And Mark and I even do that ourselves.
I just messed it up because I don't remember.
Doesn't that drive you crazy as a Latin person, Fausto? It drives me crazy.
No, everything is female in Spanish, and except when it comes to iPhones and iPods and technological devices, I always call them male. And I can see people, when I'm talking about it in Spanish with people, and I can see they get unnerved by that. Because it sexualizes their device for them.
Ooh, they're handling a man.
They have a man in their hands. Ooh. So part of it is you use the gender pronoun, and you choose it, what's going to make people most nervous.
Oh, so you do that on purpose, right?
Yes, absolutely. It's a weapon for LGBT people, and we should definitely use gendered language as a weapon to raise awareness. Yes.
When you want to make like a French man really mad, you just like put like a feminine thing. It's like, I just seem like in a feminine way, and he will lose his shit for real. Mm-hmm. He will get crazy. What did you call me?
Let me ask you about Paris. When I was young, I was in college and I stayed with a family in Paris, and they lived in Neuilly. They were pretty well off.
Bougie.
Oh, very bougie. And they had a very, very nice, very, very nice place, and they had a very nice car. But I remember I read about like the Bois de Boulogne, and I read that there's like these sex workers, and a lot of them were like, you know, at the time they probably just said they were men dressed up as women or something like that. Or, you know, because even transgender probably wasn't even a word back then. Or it wasn't in common use. I was very interested in it. I said this to them and they said, oh, we'll take you. You know, it's very famous and they're from Brazil. And they drove me around. I'm the young kid in the back of their car looking at Brazil. Most of them were from Brazil, sex workers. And they, you know, they look like drag queens because they had big costumes on. A lot of them had their breasts out and were shaking them. It was intense.
This is the first time I've heard this story, by the way.
Have you ever been there?
But you know, it's like the Bois de Boulogne is like Central Park. It's really huge.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know why they brought you to the part with the sex workers.
I talked to them about it because I think I read it in a tourist brochure.
Oh, so you wanted to see it?
I wanted to see it, yes.
Oh,
and I think
they also drove
me by a place where the male sex workers were. There was some guys like leaning up against cars and stuff like that.
Were the male sex workers anybody you would want to have sex with?
We went by so fast. It was that I was kind of like trying not to really even notice.
In the early 90s, me and my friends went to Miami Beach for an artist conference. And we were shocked at how attractive the homeless people were and the sex workers were. Like, because usually, like, you see a homeless person or a sex worker in, like, New York or Chicago, and this not, you don't go, oh, you know, this person's you think this person has had some hard times or there's adversity there. And you just go, this person could be on the cover of Vogue magazine, and they're here standing on a street corner at 3 a.m. asking for $20 for a blowjob. And you're just like, going, what the hell is going on with this economy, you know, in this culture? Because these people looked well-dressed, well-fed, and they're just, but they had a look on their face like, I'm at the edge of, you know, I'm on the edge of glory, and I'm waiting for a moment with you. You know what I'm saying?
So, okay, come
and
on,
I want to bring this up because this happens to a lot of people. There's Paris syndrome and Jerusalem syndrome. This idea,
Stockholm syndrome.
Stockholm. Well, that's a different thing. Mm-hmm. But and when people meet famous drag queens, they have these high expectations and realize that Paris or Jerusalem or these famous drag queens are just ordinary people. They're not gods. They're not Valhalla. It's not a legend. Mm-hmm. It's just a city with beautiful people and rotten people and dumpsters and garbage cans and you know, poverty. And they lose their minds, especially as happens to Asian tourists who go to Paris or really young kids who meet drag queens for the first time. They throw temper tantrums.
Oh, God. But I still think I can understand that, especially with the economy globally now, you see a lot more of people that were young people who you didn't expect to end up like in such poverty or odd situations now. So I get that. But I also feel that Paris is still a very strong and open city for artists. It's not, even though it's kind of sometimes I feel like a fake image, it still has a lot of opportunities for artists. Mm. For me, it's still like, even though everybody's saying, oh, it's Berlin now and everything, I still feel like when it comes to comparison to New York, I still, Paris is still the European second one, yes.
Well, you guys actually put money into funding the arts. You guys put money into your education. Although you guys came awfully close to having a Nazi for president, Marie Le Pen, you guys are still, relatively speaking to the rest of the world, a very progressive community, and you put your money into your healthcare. You put money into your infrastructure. You don't have mass shootings like we do here. Like, you have had terrorist attacks, but it's not like in 2018. We've had, it feels like it's every other day, you know, and it's, and that's something to say about the strength of your society.
But it's also weird. I think sometimes it's always bad to compare, for example, France and the US, because we are not at the same scale at all. I mean, we're not even like the size of Western New York State. It's not the same people. It's not the same problems. It's not the same issues we have to deal with here. But just to go back to the art thing, I think at least here, when I say that I'm a visual artist and that's what I do, it's my full-time job, I don't get as judged or like people rolling their eyes as other part of the world when I travel, where people are like, yeah, but what do you do for money? Yeah, who is paying for you? Who's your sugar daddy, honey?
Okay, time out. Hold up, sweetheart. Let's get it together before you want to read. I don't have a sugar daddy. Everything I've had, I've worked for, and I worked to get, and I built myself. I need you to know that 100%. I don't have a sugar daddy. I've never had a sugar daddy, and if I wanted a sugar daddy, yes, I could probably go out and get one because I am what? Sickening. You could never have a sugar daddy because you are not that kind of girl, baby. Everything I have worked for, and I've got myself, I built myself from the ground up, you fucking bitch. How does a drink in your face? Said the great philosopher Shangela to Mimi I'm First.
I can't believe you got that whole thing memorized. Amazing.
Thank you.
No, I would just say, well, maybe you. I don't know.
Maybe with you? What is that Eartha Kitt said in the middle of her song Ceci Bone at Live at the Plaza on the album?
Are you familiar with that song?
You're the expert.
It doesn't matter to me what languages you speak. Parce que vous pouvez parler anglais, français, italien, espagnol, allemand, au prochain, sous petite chance, comme ribru ou rien. You can meet me in my dressing room. Vous pouvez me rencontrer dans la lounge après le show.
Le show.
Le show. You get what I mean, don't you? Mark is pretty bilingual.
I studied French in college, and I spent some time in France and in Quebec. But, you know, it's been a long time. I can still, like, read it. Like, if I pick up a French magazine and stuff, I can pretty much read and understand most of it. There's some words that I don't know, but...
But you're part French, right? Your name
my
is
family's,
French.
My dad's family is French-Canadian. So his father... my father grew up in a house with his grandmother who spoke French. So
good. So I don't feel that when I was living in the US, I feel like it's so strange. People always told me that French people are rare here, but I know so many in the US. Maybe we just don't mix with other people. I don't know.
Well, you know, the French Canadians, especially when you think about the colony of France, it was only colonized by about 10,000 people. And then colonization stopped, basically. People from France stopped coming over for the most part. And so out of those 10,000 people, I mean, there's millions and millions of Americans that can trace their ancestry back to French Canada, you know, including Lady Gaga and Madonna. We're probably all related. True.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny because, you know, the United States wouldn't be what it is today if it wasn't for the influence of French politicians and philosophers and culture.
Yeah. And even as you said, in the drag culture, there are so many French name and references everywhere. And I feel that's something that a lot of people don't realize, that there's still this very strong European influence in drag. And it's so ironic now that what's becoming huge here in Europe is like an Americanized version of drag, which is still very good. But I'm always really asking myself question when I just enter like a French bar and I see somebody with like lip syncing on Nicki Minaj and Anaconda and just very seriously without any twist, and I'm like, okay.
Where's that? Well, let's do a little French vocabulary. How do you say top? Okay. Top.
Okay, so that's the useful part of the podcast.
Yeah.
Like for travelers, how do you say top?
Yeah.
Well, it's actually, again, like Fausto, it's the same thing as in Spanish. So can you guess?
Actif.
Yes. So you know.
And
yes,
bottom actif. Is passif?
Yes.
And blowjob?
Well, that's something that you can like... that's funny. How can I explain that? You know when you're smoking a cigarette, but it's not a cigarette, it's a
peep.
It's a pipe.
Yeah.
Yes.
Taille mon peep.
Isn't that what that famous painting, This Is Not a Pipe?
Yes.
That's that's a reference to a blowjob.
Yes.
Yes.
It's a reference to a blowjob. But I never understood anyway why we're saying that, because it doesn't make any sense.
And that's Magritte's painting, who's also a French surrealist.
A Belgian one.
He was a Belgian?
Yes, but he used to live, like Picasso, for example, is like Spanish, but they're so linked to France, you know, that you consider them French artists.
So that's how far back this joke goes, you know, this is not a pipe, you know, a pipe as a blowjob. As a euphemism there.
Well, so what kind of gay slang has infiltrated the French language? Is there anything that we use that you guys now use?
I think it's the same thing as RuPaul Drag Race. Everything is getting Americanized here. So I guess like we can say top and bottom, which sounds with like a French accent, which is, I should do it like with a really bad French accent. Oh, je suis un top. Which from me is like a stretch, you know.
Well, one of the most commonly used words, everybody, sachet chanté, both French words.
Yeah, but nobody uses.
But people say enchanté.
Yes, we do. It like, but it's like.
And enchanté is slang for chanté is short for enchanté. I'm enchanted, so therefore you stay.
I never understood like this sachet chanté kind of thing.
That's a New York. I think that's from African Americans who speak French in New York. That's the slang they come up with. So sachet is I'm not sure what is the sachet.
Sachet away is to move in a certain way. I want to say that's
of the word
I want to say it's Polari.
It might be Polari, but a chanté means and a lot of things is RuPaul doesn't spell it correctly.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, like a lot of French name anyway, with like the AY kind of thing, which is fun anyway.
Ashanti has an accent on the E, kind of like your name, your last name. That's Saucier. Like, Ashanti.
Saucier. Yeah. Which is like from like the east part of France, the north, but like the northeast part of France. So there's a lot of things with A, it's, yeah, we have like, that's why when I am in the US or anywhere else, like, except if it's a Latin country, it's just, people just don't pronounce my name. They're just like, okay, so C, so Sai, whatever.
You just need to tell them it's Marc Saucier as in Shantae. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That's how you remember. And both are spelled exactly. If you go to feastoffun.com/store, you can get yourself a Shantae t-shirt with Shantae spelled correctly, mm-hmm. with an accent on the E. And I was like, I was doing so much research to find out, because I was like, there is no way it's spelled that way. And so I looked high and low and found that Shantae is the derivation of Enchanté. Mm-hmm.
And RuPaul actually asked, somebody asked her that on Twitter, and she said that is correct.
Yes.
That it is from Enchanté.
And it's verified.
Because you guys, like, Enchanté sounds very ostentatious to us, but you guys say it is like, pleased to meet you.
And in the Rocky Horror Picture Show, Dr. Frankenfurter, when he kisses her hand, he goes, Enchanté.
But it's still like a very posh thing. That's maybe because you were in Neuilly, Mark. And like, but it's not, you would say maybe when you're like at a fancy dinner party, but I wouldn't be like, you wouldn't do that like to anybody.
No?
It's okay. Very like, but I mean,
I remember people saying
maybe
it,
40 you know, years ago they would have.
Yeah.
I mean, because that was a thing that was done. That was what Dr. Frankenfurter was referencing that movie.
But he was also trying to be posh in that movie. He was trying to be, you know, aristocratic. But you know, it's funny you say that because it's like when I stayed with them for a couple weeks, and then I you know, I'd studied French in college, and then I went to visit this girl that I knew in Normandy, who's she had stayed with my family. And when I spoke to her in French, she started laughing at me, and I was like, "Why are you laughing?" Yes. She goes, because you sound so snobby.
Yes.
And I was just like, is that not a good thing? She's just like, no, it's just, it's ridiculous how snobby you sound. And like, because I had been with these people who were like, you know, they were very well off.
Yeah, where you were is like the high society of like the Parisian, like it's the wealthiest suburb of Paris where you were.
Yeah.
Where do you see yourself as an artist in 5 years from now? Like, where are you wanting to sort of take this marriage of the visual art and performance?
I want to make it like something stronger. I mean, for example, I look at what Sacha Velour has been doing, like in Brooklyn with his show. I want to do something that's really merging visual arts and drag, because that's, for me, that's the same thing. But I want to be, at the same time, a performer, but I want also to produce shows. I want to be able to put at least here drag on a better pedestal and not being just something that you see in a dive bar. I want people to see it as a real art form and not something that's just for like a show at 2 a.m. in the morning, you know? So I want to have more means and more ways of doing this, using more technology, using things that are differently referential to art movement, to what's happening right now in contemporary art. I want something that's just merging everything together.
Well, you know, the solution to that is get in a time machine and travel back to the early 90s, because most gay bars wouldn't, if they didn't specifically have drag shows, they wouldn't allow people even to come into the bars and drag, because your identification had to match your physical appearance. And so unless you were like a club kid or in a like a raver scene or something like that, you had to do it in art galleries. So a lot of art galleries, like you look at like someone like Joey Arias, or certainly, you know, a lot of those are early Wigstock drag queens. They were not doing their shows necessarily in gay bar venues as much as in theaters and art galleries. So the fact that nowadays we have more drag in gay bars is a very recent thing.
And that's a testament to the power of television more than anything.
The power of pine saw, baby.
I just feel that sometimes here it's again because we're not like a culture like the English or the US people. drag has still a lot of things to show and to prove here. It's not still socially acceptable for people, even when I present myself as a drag queen. It's a lot of people are just, for them, it's like being like, they don't make a difference between drag queen and like being transgender. Or it's there's a lot of education to be made here. And I always feel, even though like Paris people are going to get really mad from about me saying this, but I feel sometimes we're just behind when it comes to social and gay issues. We are like behind 5 years with the US all the time. And again, that's what I said at the beginning of the podcast. I feel what I'm seeing here happening, like this drag renaissance in Paris, is something that happened a long time ago because of RuPaul Drag Race in the US, but it's starting only now, which is a great thing because now we are able to kind of guess which direction it's going.
Does being sort of this gender nonconforming visual artist who also is very attracted to horror, does that affect your romantic life as a gay man or as a queer person?
Yeah, I feel it's I've always been like this kind of introspective person, very like into movies. I was always by myself drawing. I'm an only child, so I had to find my own ways of entertaining myself. So I'm very good by myself. That's why I'm able to create projects and spend like days and days working on things. But I think I've been developing myself in such specific ways that it's really hard to find simply a match sometimes, or somebody that respects what you do and try to understand it. But I don't feel it's necessarily because I like horror things, because a lot of people anyway like them. But it's another thing when you go to that other step and you're actually doing it like as a full-time job, and also because it's not even a full-time job, it's a way of life, it's your everyday. And for a lot of people working 9 to 5 and depending on like on weekends or vacations to live their life, it's really a different rhythm and hard to comprehend. But it's been better. I think like again with like this drag renaissance kind of thing, it's people are getting accepting it more and more. But it's still something very weird for people. I mean, being an artist has never been easy anyway.
Well, you know, certainly La Boheme shows the universality of the struggle of the bohemian artist.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, for Americans, we have Rent, the musical. Mm-hmm. But it's about that, you know, for people who live. My mother always said that the value of an artist is that they live in the margins of society and they give society the tools to understand itself better because they're looking at the world from the outside in.
And you have also to accept to be attacked by this world also and being able to respond to it. Because there is like this kind of, I feel sometimes you can see society as a body, you know, like a human body. And you feel like you are something that's apart from this body. And sometimes it feels like it's attacking you because it feels that you're not useful, that you're not being part of the group.
Sure.
And so you have to stand for yourself and to the long run, proving to people that actually what you're doing is like the value of this. And it, as you said, it's like putting a mirror to people showing you're more than what you're doing. You're more than your job. You're more than what you're seeing yourself as. And I think that's what the artist is doing. And that's why also when you see a great drag show, you're like, whoa, it's referential to this, to that. It's something that brought me to another place.
Or you're just a rebel just for kicks. You've been doing it since 1966. Sasha Kills, you are killing us and giving us life with your horrifically beautiful drag and visual art. It is such a delight to chat with you today. And I'm sorry that you lived in Chicago. We never got to meet each other.
It was like back in 2011, 2012, but maybe you've seen me, but I would remember you, but I was always like in Boys Town. I was living in Lakeview, so I was like living my Twinkie life, gay life, and you're like, oh my God, like, let's go to Roscoe's right now.
Yeah. So, They renamed Roscoe's. Did you know that?
They did.
Yeah, they call it RuPaul's Drag Race now.
Oh.
They're like, you drive past that bar, and all it says is RuPaul's Drag Race in the front of the bar. And I actually heard somebody going, oh, wow, there's a RuPaul's Drag Race bar in this town.
Television.
I was like, girl, yeah. The power up pants all, baby. Mm-hmm.
But my favorite was Berlin anyway, so I was always ending like in the late night Berlin things.
Were you part of a Red Rum Satanics panic scene?
She didn't do drag here.
Were you familiar with that at all?
No. I really studied like drag in LA.
Yeah, so there's a group of girls and guys, burlesque artists, who do shows based on the Satanic Panic films of the 70s and 60s. It's pretty outrageous stuff. And it's sort of embracing this idea that, you know, we're all going to become Satanists if we just let loose our morals.
Sounds great to me.
Merci, Marc, pour votre participation à cette émission. Do you like?
Oh, nice. Okay. Well, c'était un plaisir.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sasha Kills.
Thank you, Sasha.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bonsoir. Sasha Kills lives in Paris, France. I can see her wearing women underpants and other delicious things on her Instagram account, Sasha Kills You, and she is killing us and giving us life with her spooky, kooky drag.
And do check out her artwork at marcsaucier.com, and her other her drag website is sashakills.com.
Yeah, she's a drag queen who actually owns domain names based on her names.
On her work, exactly.
I love that.
You know, I want to remind folks, too, we can't talk to wonderful people like Mark if it weren't for people like you who support this podcast. If you're not a Plus member, consider signing up at feastoffun.com/plus, because your contribution to the show is what makes this show happen.
Honey, my long distance bill is going to be a little higher this month, I'll tell you that. And we you know, if you want us to interview somebody that you think is extraordinary, give us some talking points, tell us their story, mail us at mail@feastoffun.net .com. And please, put a little tip in our tip jar at feastoffun.com/donate, honey.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.